Hi everyone, I'm Sean Maloney from Nutraceuticals World. Sustainability is a broad term that gets tossed around a lot these days in different contexts, to the point where it's not always clear what it means. A report released this year from Nielsen IQ and McKinsey showed that consumers are shifting their spending toward products with environmental, social, and governance-related claims, or ESG claims. To better understand how sustainability relates to the herb and botanical value chain, I recently talked with Anne Armbrecht, the director of the Sustainable Herbs Program, which operates under the auspices of the American Botanical Council. The program recently updated its Sustainability and Regenerative Practices Toolkit, which is an expansive collection of resources that can help companies implement ecologically and socially responsible practices. Anne is an anthropologist, an herbalist, and an author whose books include The Business of Botanicals, Exploring the Healing Promise of Plant Medicines in a Global Industry, which raises questions about the ethical and ecological issues of mass production of medicines derived from plants, many of which are imperiled in the wild. Anne is also co-producer of the documentary Newman, The Healing Power of Plants. In connection with the toolkit, Anne talked about quality, waste, regenerative agriculture, and collaborations within industry that are designed to meet common goals. As the Nielsen IQ and McKinsey report noted, the sheer size of the CPG sector, which includes the $60 billion dietary supplement industry, makes it a critical component in efforts to build a more sustainable and inclusive economy. So with that in mind, here's my interview with Anne Armbrecht. So Anne, for background and context, could you tell us a little bit about how the Sustainable Herbs Program developed, what your mission has been, and the key issues you're focused on?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So it started, well, I'm an anthropologist by training and then came and studied herbal medicine and have had no experience in industry. And it started really because I wanted to tell the stories of the people and places behind finished herbal products. I wanted to know whether knowing those stories might make us make more ethical choices in the grocery store, pay not just attention to the price, but also to sort of the impact of that choice. And so it was really a consumer-directed project initially, with the herb audience especially. And so I created this multimedia website that included video stories of where the plants were from and some of the stories of the people whom I got to know. And I quickly realized that to make change, it really needed to happen in the companies that were sourcing, you know, not just pounds or kilos of herbs, but tons and container loads. And around that time, I was looking for a home for the program because I didn't want to create a new organization. And so Mark Blumenthal and I talked about having it become a program at American Botanical Council. And so when it became a program there, that really, you know, the mission stayed the same, really, to raise awareness and inspire more action around the responsible and ethical sourcing of herbs, sort of more broadly around sustainability and in the botanical industry. But my interest has always really been a lot on the sourcing side. And so that's been the mission, and now really working with companies to have those conversations beyond just talking about the need for sustainability, but really, what does that mean? What action needs to be taken and how do we get there?
Yeah. So to that end, you developed the Sustainability and Regenerative Practices Toolkit, which is a collection of resources to help people understand and implement ecologically and socially responsible practices in the botanical industry. Can you elaborate on what's in this toolkit and who it's intended for?
Sure. So to back up just a teeny bit, so when I think about how to bring about change, or there seem to me three areas that I focus on or think about. One is really seeing the system. To change a system, you need to see it. And so that's the part of the work that's around producing video stories that are on the website. It's around the book that I wrote that's following herbs through the supply chain to the source, to really see the industry from the perspective of all the different players from the field, you know, collectors and farmers, to the finished product manufacturers, not just from my own perspective. So that's the first part, is seeing the system. And then the second is tools to make change. I'll talk about that because that's a toolkit. But then the third is collaboration, really. because these issues are so challenging, we need to come together. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit too, but sure. For now, the toolkit. So early on, when I thought about the work I wanted to do in the herb community, it was really to bring about the same kind of grassroots movement in herbalism that the food movement has really inspired around food. And I didn't see that same awareness happening, you know, this real concern about where herbs are from, where the herbs and products or dietary supplements are from, how they're handled, and the impacts of that on the people and the earth. And so the food movement was in my consciousness, and there's so many resources available. Like, it's an overwhelming amount around where food is from and how to bring about change. And so that kind of inspired me to bring together resources that I would come across in my own work. So it was kind of a way just for myself to gather all that information into one place so I wouldn't lose it. But it was also really to both have information about the botanical industry in one place, but really bring examples from other sectors, which have done a lot more in many of these areas than I have seen in the urban dietary supplement sector. And so it's to bring all those resources in one place to be used in different ways. I mean, my idea and vision is that it's used, I've taught college classes before, you know, so it's kind of as a college class, yeah, but in the form of like a team at a company meets once a month, picks a section of the toolkit, you know, there's information about watch this video, here are some discussion questions, and then here are further resources to dive in and explore those. You know, I know everybody's busy and has many different demands, and that I don't know how likely that idea is that it will actually be a reality. So then there are ways, you know, an individual person can use it just as a resource guide to when they're asking specific questions around, say, wild harvesting and sourcing. Here's a bunch of information in one place to get access to that information.
Yeah, there's lots of links in it that sort of extend to other resources and case studies. So there's a lot to review through these. There's certainly a lot available for companies throughout the, you know, the structure of a company, right? It's really something for everybody in there, it seems.
One thing that we're going to try out, and I don't know if there'll be interest or and how it will go, is beginning maybe May or maybe September, we'll see, to have sort of a monthly Skillshare session or for Sustainable Herbs Program members that's on, say, a specific topic where people new to it can learn from one or two people who have already, you know, say, tracing herbs to the source, you know, how you really or how you do a risk assessment for a particular region, or so that there is some in-person training to see if there's an interest to kind of bring this content alive, because, you know, there's so much content online, you know, so many toolkits, so many resources, and that's only useful to the extent that it's used. And so I'm trying to think how to make it be used.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also have a series of webinars that people can attend and review for more in-depth review of specific areas of the toolkit, right?
Yeah. And those, so we came out with a version one of this a couple of years ago. I think it was like right before COVID hit. And then as part of the rollout for that, we thought, oh, well, let's just try and do these webinars. And it was the time of, you know, everybody suddenly was on Zoom. And so there was an astonishingly large attendance for those. It was really surprising and a lot of interest. So we kept them going for, you know, I paused them right now this month, but otherwise they've been going for two years. And there seems there's a real interest in, you know, learning from those who are thinking about these issues in a conversational setting. They're not presentation format. I think to me, I prefer that. There's also a lot of presentations out there. And so just to change that up a little bit, the new toolkit version, partly why we shared an update, is that I included the links to those webinars in the different sections of the toolkit.
Are there other substantive updates in the second edition that we should know about?
That's the biggest substantive one through the whole thing. Is what, then there's, you know, more minor updating the sections and the resources. And I had an assistant, she started as an intern, and then I hired her, who helped design these great infographics that I love. Mm-hmm. Those are in there to help make it a little more visually, not just photos, but how to use some of this. And then the design is different. I wanted to try and make it be something that was a little easier to read online, which is how people will be working with it.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what's at stake here, in terms of climate change and the impacts on the botanical industry, grower, throughout the value chain. What effects are climate change and biodiversity loss currently having on the herbal botanical value chain, and who's most vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think everywhere's impacted. You know, just at APA, Matt Dubala, who's the farm manager at Herb Farm, was on a farmer panel, and he was talking about how the fires in Oregon are impacting, that the smoke and the haze impacts photosynthesis, which impacts the growth and the yields of their crop, which means they need to think about planting sooner if they want to get the same yield. So that's one impact. Another is that the smoke and the water, I think, the added rains are creating more fungal growth on the plants. Another impact is during the smoke, when it's so bad, farm workers have to wear masks, and, you know, it's like 100 degrees out there or something like that. So there's harder conditions. So I give that as this tiny example of the many different ramifications. And those are discomfort or profit impacts. Those aren't like life and death, and there are life and death impacts happening as well. I was just looking in the recent, the IPCC came out with a synthesis update report, you know, and it's another one of those reports that say things are really dire, but there's still hope if we act right now. And then it seems we all kind of sit there and wait until another report comes out and tells. But it was,
but I think that was the final report, right? It's sort of now or never, right? It's the time to act. It was yesterday, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing they were saying was that almost half of the world's population lives in regions that are highly vulnerable to climate change. And those are in that swath of, you know, Africa, Asia, the middle, more tropical regions where a lot of the botanicals come from, that are the recipients of the negative causes of climate change and rarely the actors causing it. Last year, Jane Frank, who used to work at NUMITI, talked about a report she saw on the impacts of climate change on the tea growing areas in Assam, where they've sourced most of their tea. And she said I can't remember the year, but tea could no longer be grown there because of the impacts of climate change. And she said, you know, the long-term viability, as a company, the long-term viability of our company is at risk, but the long-term livelihood and viability of these people whom she'd come to know was at risk. And so there's that in the longer term. And then, you know, everywhere where you go, the farmers talk about rains coming late or early or not the same amount, more or less. And Joseph Brinkman said a while ago in an interview when we were filming him, he said, you know, people who question climate change, you just need to get out more, talk to farmers.
You know, I want to really get into the steps that industry can take to increase resilience. The toolkit has several main issues. I want to highlight a few, and we can certainly talk more about more. Quality, waste, and regenerative agriculture are three that I wanted to maybe sort of dig into a little bit. Can you discuss quality and what that means in the context of sustainability?
Sure. Maybe it starts with a definition of quality, right? Quality has tended to be something that's in the lab measured, the quality of the end product, and that this, whether it meets specifications of my company. And what I think is unique about herbal medicine is that the quality of that sample is directly connected to how that raw material has been handled from the field, from the wild harvesting or farming field, all the way to that sample. And so that broader definition of quality, then a lot of other things are taken into account. It's the quality of the soil. What's in the soil? Is it near a manufacturing plant? What's the quality of the air? Is the water, you know, is it a polluted river that's irrigating it? Even an organic field, you know, how those kind of ecological impacts, biodiversity, all of those, as well as the quality of the workers' experience. I came into this thinking, you know, I wanted to see whether, because herbalists talk about the importance of intention, which is kind of my intention as a practitioner, how that showed up in global supply networks. And I found out that was a really naive question, of course, in global supply chains. But there is, it's not necessarily intention, it's attention. And if people are paying attention when they're harvesting weeding, right, to get out all the weeds, or when they are taking, you know, a person receiving wild harvested sacks at a collection unit, that they're really making sure there's not other species mixed in there, that it's dried correctly, that attention impacts the quality. And so what helps all of us pay attention better, right? Being cared for, like getting a decent salary, but not only that, like being respected, being listened to, just basic common human kind of things that aren't about supply chains, that are about being people. And those are, so those, I got a little strayed from your question, but that to me, like those are aspects of quality. And that shows up in things like contracts, you know, making sure I have a buyer for my turmeric that I've harvested. And Tony Booker in the UK, we had did a webinar with him, and he talked about his research, which shows directly the impact that they've measured, done chemical studies to measure the constituents in turmeric that was purchased through contracts, a company that had a contract with the a producer group that had a contract with the farmers. So those farmers harvested and sold it on time versus turmeric that was bought and sold in the open market. And there was a difference in that. And that's because the turmeric bought and sold on the open market was stored. They kept it in poor storage facilities until the price went up again. So these things, this broader view, impacts quality. And so it can be seen as sustainability, like caring for the ecosystem, caring for the people, but it's not. It's all, I think. And that's that division, I think, maybe slows companies down in taking action.
The toolkit also talks about waste significantly. There's a significant amount of waste in the botanical industry, in processing and whatnot. I wonder if you could maybe talk about how responsible companies are evaluating waste streams or managing waste in their processing.
I think the main way the ethical companies, to call it that, are dealing with it is in the raw material and in the material, is investing in making sure what they get is meets their specifications so they don't have to reject it. Mm-hmm. And so that's investing in the supply network all the way from the beginning, which goes back to those points about quality, seeing that it's not just an extra sustainability, it's ensuring that they get what they need and they don't have to reject it. And that has an impact also in, you know, like manufacturing facilities. So often a brand has a contract manufacturer or something, but it benefits that contract manufacturer also to have less material you'll go through that then has to be wasted, because that costs money, but nobody's documenting how much it costs. And actually, at the Sustainable Herbs Program, the advisory group, we talked about possibly trying to document that, but it was just too big of a project to figure out how you even begin to measure that, the value of that waste, to try and inspire companies to take some more action. One way, and this was a few years ago when we visited Indina in Italy, they were they were investing a lot before in figuring out that they could use the least, the most harmless, I don't know the right way to say it, solvent. Solvent is this other topic nobody really wants to talk about in the dietary supplement industry, but to use the best solvents for extracting and then reuse them as much as they could, you know, within all the quality control ways that you need to manage something like that, but as a way of minimizing that waste. And I'm sure a lot of companies do some aspect of that because of the cost of solvents. So, and then we have one case study, and I should update and look for others around Uramed, which was partnering with a dye company to use the waste from saw palmetto for dyeing clothing. And I know Brian Zapp at Applied Food Sciences, they were looking at a possible use of, I think, the cascara bark, you know, mm-hmm. from the coffee, you know, so finding other multiple uses for a single product, which to go back to your question about finding resilience, that's a way to support the farmers, because if they have two products instead of one, that just builds a little more resilience into their supply.
You mentioned regenerative agriculture earlier, and I think I did as well, but I wonder if you could talk about the progression of that, where this movement and practice is heading, and maybe how it's different from maybe just a definition standpoint, how regenerative agriculture may differ from organic.
Sure, and we just today, we have a 20-minute video we just launched today that's really diving more into regenerative farming in some farms that we visited in Costa Rica, and that can explain it more authoritatively with those people who really understand the soil microbiome. I can only repeat what they've said. Sure. But that's on the Sustainable Herbs Program website. In my experience in the herb industry, it was often discussed wild harvested versus cultivated. And there wasn't a lot of talk about how the cultivation happened and what the focus on regenerative has brought more attention to is that it really matters, the soil health really matters, and how monocrop or mixed cropping, all those things really impact the quality of the environment in which the crops are grown. And so I think that's really important that it's brought that conversation forward. I think like anything, there's a big risk of the word being watered down, and what does that really mean? I know, you know, Herb Farm and Gaia have become regenerative organic certified, which is a very rigorous certification. And I think especially for Herb Farm, they said, so there are three pillars for that certification. And it brings in this human component, which organic doesn't necessarily. So, you know, I think people who talk about regenerative, it's kind of going back to the farming practices and the whole ecosystem approach that organic really started with. And it kind of incorporates fairness and equity into that as a certification that the certification of organic doesn't include. Although I think the original intent of organic farmers, it was about equity and care and wellness for humans and the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's talking about regenerative too, though. So there's a real danger of it just being a buzzword.
Yeah, I was going to next ask you about how concerned you are about greenwashing and sort of companies trying to capitalize on claims that may resonate with consumers, but not actually have any backing behind it.
I mean, I was talking to someone at Expo West, an ingredient supplier, and they were talking about how everywhere you went, you see sustainable, 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 and very few of their buyers ask them any questions about their sourcing practices. They just ask the price. So I think there's a real risk of that, and that requires being educated. So that's back to that first point I was making about seeing the system. Consumers need to be ask better questions, listen harder. You know, I've done little mini research projects like trying to look for information on black cohosh. And so I'll email all these companies about asking where their black cohosh is from. And 90% of them would say, oh, it's cultivated. Well, 97% of the black cohosh is wild harvested. And so then I would ask more questions. And then finally, they would stop responding. And so I think the more we as buyers of these products know what questions to ask, Like, what does it really mean to be regenerative? What do you mean when you're saying that? Can you give me an example? You know, and that takes work. And my next goal is to create a much smaller but sort of similar consumer-directed toolkit guide to the questions to ask to kind of be able to filter through that greenwashing.
Yeah, that could be a challenge for consumers right now, yeah. I'm sure. There was a Nielsen IQ and McKinsey report recently about sustainability claims, and it seemed clear that consumers are willing to pay a premium for products that make these environmental, social governance claims, ESG claims, but really understanding what that means and digging in deeper to make the consumer responsible for that and deciphering what's legitimate and what's not. I don't know, it seems a little unfair to the consumer. I think I agree that maybe industry needs to be more clear about what we're talking about, what these claims mean, and have backing behind them, and if you're going to make them.
You know, I wonder, going back to that point, that seeing that the long-term viability of any company that depends on plant material from around the world has to be investing in the soil health, in farmer equity, wild collector care, you know, or there's not going to be farmers to do the work, or there's not going to be wild collectors, or there's not going to be plants, that the long-term viability of their business depends on it. Is maybe I don't know how, you know, and that goes back to the quality thing that, and risk assessments. And
have you noticed an uptick in the number of mission-driven companies and B Corp certified companies?
So to the third point that I was saying, collaboration, that's really what I've been focusing on, is collaboration among companies. And it's a really strong group. And to me, it feels like a small group. Feels like there could be a lot more companies in there, and maybe they're elsewhere, you know, and I'm sure there's a lot of food companies, but there's a lot of bigger herb companies, but dietary supplement companies especially, who can be doing more.
As an anthropologist, how do you reflect on our relationship, humanity's relationship with nature? Particularly in light of climate change and all the challenges that we face?
Big question.
I know, it's very broad. It's a huge question. You could write another book about that one, I'm sure. Maybe going back in time a bit, and you've spent time around the world with you know, different communities. Because especially in the botanical industry, we are extracting something beneficial to us from the earth, and we're using it in a way that's, you know, supposed to be beneficial for us. And yes, we put back in terms of regenerative agriculture, at least some companies do, ethical companies do, and many more should. But then there's this other component where we've really forgotten that this is the planet we live on and that we need to take care of it. You know, I wonder how you see that dichotomy, that split. And you know, how it makes you feel. I mean, do you get discouraged about the path we're on? Are you hopeful we can course correct? I mean, I wonder, you know, how you see it, how you see things.
Yeah. So to me, I think what drew me to herbalism in the beginning is that it has, herbal medicine, as that I studied with Rosemary Gladstar, has this relationship with the plants and by extension the earth, that's not transactional. It's reciprocal. It's one of respect. It's one of, you know, the intrinsic value of the plant and the earth, not just a resource for my use. So I feel like that's at the heart of anything when we're working with plants. And my interest in the herbal industry is because I see, like, that's a potential. Like, there is at the heart of this industry that's developed around this relationship with plants, could that offer a pathway to right relationship with the earth? You know, and I don't know, the jury's still out on that, but in this of companies that collaborating at the Sustainable Herbs Program Learning Lab, there's about 20, 25, you know, we begin with that aliveness of the plants. And, you know, like someone does a, you know, calls in the plants. And then it's talking about the challenges of sourcing in very pragmatic, concrete terms. But we're trying to start from this different non-transactional relationship, non-extractive relationship. So that gives me hope, because I think that there's, we're drawn to that, and it's shifting how people are working. And then in my personal life, you know, that's where I'm drawn to circles where people talk about that. They're not talk, but there's plenty of other circles where people have a totally extractive, exploitative relationship. So I have, you know, is that a turning point? I don't know. I went back to Nepal for the first time. You know, I lived there for about 4 years in the 80s and 90s, and went back for the first time in November. And it's heartbreaking, like the scale of change. And, you know, it's a scale of change in many parts of the world. It's similar, but to see that, to have left and then come back. And I was just left by wondering what can make a difference. You know, there it's like population growth, urban sprawl, climate change, degradation of the earth, people shifting from rural areas to cities. And so that makes me feel overwhelmed. And I'm a mother and I have kids. And so I have to have hope, and I get up, you know, and I stay focused and find the circles where people are doing the best we can, they can.
Yeah.
And the, like, so when we were also in Nepal, we were visiting, it was this collaboration between Pukka Tea, East West Tea, that was facilitated by Martin Bauer. And they all were there, like, it was the first supplier visit any of them had done with competitors, and or that Martin Bauer had done with two of their buyers. And they said it's because the urgency of the problems in the world are more important than the little smallness of corporate competition. And so the more that companies step out of the box and come together, I think the more hope we can all have, maybe.
How else can companies come together toward the common, these common goals, and put, you know, sort of differences in competition aside?
So another interesting thing that I think is also really exciting that is happening in Sustainable Urban Program is this. So out of that webinar I mentioned that Jane Frank had done around the work NUMMI had done measuring their scope 3 emissions for specific species, which is an enormous task for any company, because they, it's not like they just have coffee or cacao. There's a whole bunch of species from around the world. And so this group, there are 8 companies, they're all brands, and they all need to begin tracking or continue tracking their scope 3 emissions of particular species, but it'd be enormously expensive and time consuming for each company to do like chamomile. So 8 life cycle analysis for chamomile. So they're coming together and they have put together this request that they're going to approach different consulting groups that are helping to provide companies with that kind of emissions data. But they're saying work with us as a group, mm-hmm. not as individual companies, because we don't want to get stuck. We don't want to spend all our resources investing in this, and we don't want to take that much time, because the point is to address the information. And so I think that's a pretty interesting example of collaboration.
Now, you said you're a mom. What's the best parenting advice you've been given? I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. So can you give me some tips?
It's the hardest question you've asked so far. Right, because I want to be really wise. You know, when this is like serious, this is not light, but when I was just worrying so much about my daughter, she was 13, and at the time when flip phones were coming out, and she said, of course, everybody had a phone, and she didn't have a phone, and not everybody had a phone, but that's what she told me. And I was so worried about it. And this woman I respect a lot said, you stand in your, like, my, who I am as a person, and in a, allegiance with who my daughter is, and that's what matters. That the phone or the not phone, those things kind of come and go, that's sort of the culture, but that what really matters is seeing her spirit in all its fullness. I thought that was I try and remember that when I get overly anxious about various things.
That's a good one. I like that. And I really appreciate all your time and insight. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the time and your attention and questions.